If it's happening today, we're talking about it now. Join us, 203-333-9422. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
And welcome back to the show. So yesterday, Connecticut lawmakers voted to extend the governor's emergency powers. Even though the pandemic has been subsiding, Governor Lamont made the case that he needs 11 of these powers to be extended because he said that they have some kind of a relationship with the federal money that's coming in. And so yesterday, the House voted mostly along party lines. They extended the powers by 73 to 56. But nine Democrats broke with their party members to vote with Republicans. The Democratic-controlled Senate voted in favor of extending the powers by 19 to 15, four Democrats breaking with their colleagues in the majority. The extension is until September 30th for 11 executive orders. One of the key aspects, said the governor, is to keep millions of dollars in federal funding flowing into the state for food stamps, housing for homeless, rent relief, and emergency needs. Our next guest, Carol Platt-Lebow, is the director of the Yankee Institute, which is a very thoughtful, penetrating, they keep their finger on the pulse of what's happening in Hartford. They are a think tank. They lean towards more, I would say, libertarian, maybe conservative, Republican lines, but not always necessarily. Carol, thank you so much for joining us right now on the Lisa Wexler Show. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Lisa. Lovely to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. So, Carol, may I call you Carol?
Of course.
Okay, great. So, Carol, give us a little bit of the substance, if you can, a summary of your op-ed that appeared in the Hearst papers today.
Well, sure. You know, Lisa, whether the governor is a Democrat or a Republican or something else, you know, the governor has had emergency powers since the pandemic began. And anyone who looks outside and has eyes to see knows we are no longer in a state of emergency that requires having a governor operate as if there were one. And of course, at a certain point, it made sense for the governor to be able to act unilaterally. You know, the point of a governor being able to have emergency powers is that when there is truly an emergency, having a single person be able to act with efficiency and dispatch without the consultation that is required when you have an entire legislature made up of all these other people with all these other opinions answering to all these other constituents, you know, you can get things done a lot more quickly, which can be necessary when there is truly an emergency and you just need to get things done. That time clearly is over. And there's a reason that our government is set up the way it is. And that reason, go ahead. Sorry.
No. So we understand. I mean, look, we understand there's a reason. There's a checks and balances. He's making the argument that these 11 powers are necessary because without them, he cannot get the money from the feds to the people who need them. Have you looked into that, Carol? Have you looked into whether or not that's true?
Yeah. No one's really explained exactly how that argument operates. And if you look, there are a lot of other states here in the Northeast, in fact, the vast majority, which no longer are operating under emergency powers. And so it isn't really clear to anyone that I've heard. I mean, this argument is being thrown around, but it's hard to believe, especially given, as we're so often told, that Governor Lamont has this fantastic relationship with President Biden, that, you know, it's necessary for a governor to rule unilaterally in order for him to be able to access federal money if that money is really needed. And, you know, Lisa, he can't really have it both ways. On the one hand, he can't argue that our state is doing so very well in terms of the number of cases, which it is, and the vaccination rates, which it is, and yet, on the other hand, claim that we are under such a state of emergency that we really must be governed in a way that has been universally understood to be necessary only in times of extraordinary crisis. It's dishonest. And what it really is doing is gaslighting the people. I mean,
so
look
let
outside.
Me ask you,
we
Carol.
All know there's no emergency.
So let me ask you this, Carol Blatt-Liebel. Let me ask you this from the Yankee Institute. Why do you think the leadership, Speaker of the House Matt Ritter, Senate Leader Bob Duff, why do you think they have gone along with the governor this time? Because I will tell you that it astonished me personally that the last couple of times when I asked these leaders about it, their answer was, in print and on the radio, that they hadn't had time to go over all of the executive orders to decide which ones they wanted to keep or not legislatively. I thought that was just astonishing. But now, when they focus on these 11, why do you think the leadership has gone along with the governor?
Well, I mean, you know, we always try and read other people's minds at our own risk, right, Lisa? But the temptation is that it allows you to avoid political blame for unpopular decisions. And
okay.
There are going to be some very controversial decisions coming up, especially with schools reopening, having to do with masking children. And whatever
right.
the governor does, there's going to be a significant portion of the population that's going to be unhappy about it. And by shoving all the responsibility to the governor for it, if it goes well, those close to the governor can take credit for it. If it goes poorly, they can absolve themselves from responsibility for it. And so it's understandable, but simply because it's understandable, that doesn't make it right.
So what you're saying is that the politicians are not brave, Carol. That's what you're saying.
Well, what a daring comment. Maybe I'm going to come along with another exciting and controversial comment like, oh, gosh, and the earth is round.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, we've been having a pretty spirited discussion. I don't know if you had a chance to hear about whether or not we're moving to a situation where we're going to have to mandate vaccines for our own good in the wake of these persistent large minority numbers. I mean, they're so large that they're almost 50% in places like Bridgeport, Hartford, in our own cities here in Connecticut. This Delta variant is taking off like a shot. We've had over 650 people die, and 98% of them were unvaccinated. Carol, does the Yankee Institute, do you personally have a thought about this? Because the two Americas that we're creating, it's not good for America. And the question is whether we allow individual liberty to take its chance and get sick and die, even if in doing so they sicken others who might be, you know, people who can't get a vaccine, who might be young people who are not approved to get a vaccine. Do we allow that in society? Or do we say, you know what, now we know this vaccine actually works. We got to suck it up the way prior generations did for tuberculosis, polio, and smallpox, and everybody's got to stick their arm out. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't ever recall there being any kind of massive resistance to smallpox, tuberculosis, and polio vaccines. People really flocked to get them. And so it seems to me one thing that the government can do to really help encourage people to get this without having to resort to mandates or other sort of authoritarian measures would be simply to answer the questions that people have, answer them honestly, answer them completely, and answer them without ridiculing people as vax deniers or somehow backwards or other things. One of the things that has really disappointed me is this new approach across the political spectrum of when people are nervous or distrustful, rather than treating them like, you know, adults worthy of respect and answering the questions and treating them respectfully, you know, there's this new contempt for them. And so it seems to me people need to do a better job of showing people the numbers, helping them assess the risk, and then going ahead and treating them like fellow citizens. And that's what I would advocate for before going ahead and trying to force people to put something.
Carol, you still there? Oops, I think she just went out. Carol? We're talking to Carol Liebau from the Yankee Institute, and she's giving us her point of view on vaccines and mandatory vaccines. And I think that she just went away. Carol, are you there? All right, Carol, if you're listening, you need to call us back. The line has dropped. We'll be right back with more of the Lisa Wexler Show.
Streaming online, on your phone, and on your smart speaker. The Lisa Wexler Show is back on WICC 600.
And we're joined by Carol Liebau of the Yankee Institute. We're talking about, Carol, so your point of view is that you think that people shouldn't be ridiculed, they shouldn't be treated with contempt if they decide not to take the vaccine. I do want to correct one thing, though, in your supposition when I compared this to tuberculosis, polio, and smallpox. Of course, you and I assume, were relatively young-ish of the same age, and we really weren't alive with the mass vaccines for tuberculosis in the beginning of the 20th century, or even polio, certainly not smallpox. But I will tell you that I did some research, and there were always some people who didn't want to take these vaccines. Those people were prosecuted to the full extent of the law, and sometimes they were put in psychiatric wards because that was the only sort of place to put them other than a jail where they could be for a while until the outbreak went away. And then there was this very famous person, Typhoid Mary, who ended up spreading typhus because she refused to get vaccinated and treated, and she ended up spreading it because she kept escaping from the psych wards. But anyway, but
yes,
my point was that
I understand. I think the mortality rates, you know, the mortality rates need to be closely examined.
Well, that's right. They were much more right. I hear you.
Right,
yeah.
And they posed a much greater danger to people across the age spectrum. My understanding is that people in the most profoundly impacted age categories, there has been no vaccine issue with any of them. Older people have not had a problem. And there's been a certain lack of transparency. I mean, I believe in vaccines. My advice would be to get vaccinated. Those 18 and above, go right on. But, you know, I'm not an expert. And I understand people having questions. I think those questions should be answered respectfully. And I think a lot should be done to try and convince people rather than to force them.
So, Carol, this is my point. So this is what I want to say to you, having an honest conversation. Really, the question is of timing, because what you're advocating is exactly what every doctor and nurse on my show has said for the last year. When I've asked them about whether we should compel people or force people, they have uniformly said exactly what you said, which is no. I'm in the healthcare field. I want to talk to people one-on-one. I want to persuade them. I don't want to force them. And that has exactly been the healthcare attitude toward people. That's why we have our mobile vans. That's why we've made a lot of information accessible. That's why on this show and WICC and Melissa through Paul all day long, all we do is give information, because we're trying to persuade people with information that getting a vaccine is most often and not necessarily always in their best interest, right? Because there could be an individual who shouldn't get a vaccine for an individual reason, but collectively for most of us, it's been a really good thing. Question is, Carol, at what point do we stop doing that, if at all, and just say, now we have historical data to show that there is effectiveness with this vaccine, and unless we get ahead of the mutations, we endanger too many people?
Well, I think we're going to need to get, I think it's impossible to answer that question, Lisa, without looking at the mortality rates that result from the mutations. Because right now, the numbers suggest that the Delta variant isn't even as deadly as the original strain of COVID was. And I think also, if you look at the messaging of the COVID vaccine, the media has done a wonderful job in telling people to get vaccinated. But part of the problem is it's only a one-way process. And, you know, I think all of us need to think more creatively about how to listen to the concerns of the communities that are not getting vaccinated rather than just pushing out one standard message that get vaccinated. I think, you know, it would be helpful if there is some sort of way to help people decide, does this make sense for me? And what are your concerns and how can we address them? And it's very difficult in a nation as large as this one.
Yeah, and
but
of course, one of the other things,
done.
I think one of the other things is a question of where people are getting their information from. So you just made a statement on the show that said that the information that you have read has said that the Delta variant is not as fatal as the original variant. That information was repeated by people like Dan Bongino and Alan Jones, who are very right-wing conservative talk show hosts.
I'm looking online,
and it says not only is the risk of death from Delta twice as high, it is so transmissible that outbreaks in Australia have been traced back to moments of, quote, scarily fleeting contact. So maybe the answer is that we don't know yet, but we are getting two different kinds of information online.
Yes, I don't listen to those shows. I don't get my information there. But I think that's part of the problem. And I think part of the problem is that all of us tend to leap to conclusions too rapidly, and that the messaging is often too lacking in nuance. And I think there's a reason that too often people fail to believe that their concerns are being heard and honored.
Yeah, well, okay. And so I hear what you're saying. I understand you're coming from the point of view of respect for an individual and respect for an individual's ability to make a decision as a free person.
There may come a time when for certain age groups it should be mandated. But this idea of forcing children to be vaccinated, young children, to me is quite unthinkable.
Well, you mean because young children are not getting the disease, and when they get it, they don't get that sick? Is that what you mean? Because it's not like a measles or a rubella for them, something like that?
And there's no evidence that they are vectors of transmission for it. And
well,
so
no,
they
spread it as much as anybody, Carol.
No,
but they absolutely
Lisa, they,
do.
No, they absolutely
yeah, they do.
Do not. They absolutely do not, Lisa. And the the CDC has even admitted as much. You need to go online and check your sources of information.
I'm definitely online all the time. I'm checking my sources constantly.
The CDC has said as much. Children do not transmit this disease. And the fact is that, you know, giving children a new vaccine that has not even been around for any period of time, that we have no idea about the long-term side effects for, when they do not transmit the disease and they do not die from the disease, when we are unaware of the long-term side effects in order to protect the old and the sick and the vulnerable, is the absolute, in my personal opinion, the absolute reverse of what a responsible society does. Responsible societies protect their young. They do not sacrifice their young to protect the older and the weaker.
Okay,
I just
have to say this. Okay, so when it comes to, I'm looking on the CDC website right now, and it talks about significant secondary transmission has occurred in school settings when prevention strategies are not implemented or not followed. In other words, when they're not wearing a mask. In Israel, prior to vaccine introduction, a school was closed less than 2 weeks after reopening when two symptomatic students attended in-person learning, leading
Lisa,
to 153 infections. I'm reading from the CDC, Carol. I gave you
I
your chance to speak on
Lisa.
The show. Let me finish. It's my show. Leading to 153 infections among students and 25 among staff members from among 1161 students and 151 staff members that were tested. Basically, they're saying that if you don't wear a mask in school, now this is at the height of the COVID you know, this is coming from the time where COVID was very much part of the population in Israel. And it basically said, of course, it can be spread in schools among kids if they're not wearing the masks. If they wear the masks, they're not going to spread the disease.
How many of them die, Lisa? How many?
No. I'm not talking about fatality. You said the word spread the disease. I know that they don't die from the disease. Poo-poo. Thank God. We know this. We can agree on this, Carol, for sure. Well, children, thank God, are not dying, but they are spreading the disease. And the spread of the disease is troubling if they come home to their household with other older people that have not been vaccinated.
I am not in front of a computer. I cannot find you the medical journals that refute a lot of what you're saying and a lot of
I'm reading it from the CDC website, so I'm not taking it from a source that you didn't cite.
I understand.
CDC.gov.
And I am telling you that children, if that were the case, you would have seen massive cases of school closings and many teachers sick. You have not seen that. And the idea that there are no secondary side effects from what we are doing to our children through requiring them to stay masked, through requiring them to live at half lives, and then requiring them to be vaccinated for a disease that does not hurt them and does not kill them, on this idea that they are somehow vectors of disease and are going to, you vaccinate the older people. You do not vaccinate the children.
Well, it's clear that you feel very strongly about this. I mean, I'm hearing that you feel very strongly about this.
I feel very strongly about it as well.
Let me clarify. What I feel strongly about is that children are spreading the disease. I'm not taking a position at all about whether they should be vaccinated, because we haven't even heard that the vaccine is safe for approval. We are nowhere near scientifically being able to force our kids to take a vaccine that hasn't even reached even emergency FDA approval, much less FDA approval. So no way.
Precisely.
No, I'm waiting for the science. I'm totally waiting for the science. I just don't want people to think that kids can't spread the disease. They can spread it, even though among themselves, they're not. Thankfully, thank God, the only silver lining in this COVID epidemic is that our children, by and large, have not gotten sick with it, except for rare exceptions. Thank God for that. Otherwise, we'd be in much worse shape, Carol. My God, it would have been a much worse thing.
Children have not, for the most part, been vectors for the spread of the disease.
So let me just ask you this, since we just have a couple of minutes and we're coming up.
Yes.
And you started out by saying that the politicians want to avoid making a decision that will likely be unpopular with a substantial amount of people in Connecticut. And we agree on that. So when it comes to masking kids in school in the fall, regardless of whether or not this vaccine is approved or not approved for kids, do you have a stance on it? It sounds like you do not think that children need to be masked to go back to school in the fall.
Yes, I do not believe children should be masked. Masking should be mandatory. I believe those parents who feel comfortable with their children being masked should certainly have the option to have their children masked. But I don't believe masks should be mandatory for children.
Do you think the governor is going to see it that way based on your looking at the pulse of where Connecticut politicians are? What do you think?
I have no idea, Lisa. I have no idea. But I do believe these decisions should be left to parents and certainly kept at the local level.
Yeah. Well, I the masking thing is an ugh. Nobody wants to wear masks. Nobody. I don't want to wear them. It's one of the first reasons I signed up to get a vaccine. Please give me the vaccine so I don't have to wear a mask anymore.
I understand. There are a lot of secondary effects, for children that are not great. And I'm sure you're aware of the Journal of the American Medical Association that shows that children often end up with carbon monoxide levels or, CO2 levels that are too high. And they shouldn't be having to put up with that. They just shouldn't have to go through their life unable to read their friends' faces or see each other's smile.
Yeah, no, there are enormous social deficits in wearing a mask during the day for children. I agree with that. Enormous.
And
they have to learn how to read faces.
To you, And I will follow up with some of the things about the disease vectors. But at any rate, it's been a pleasure to be with you and your listeners. Thank you for our conversation.
Thank you. Carol Liebau on the Yankee Institute on the Lisa Wexler Show. We're coming up against the hour. In the next hour, my sister Jill Zarin from the Real Housewives of New York City, formerly of the Real Housewives of New York City, is going to join us to talk about a controversy that's bubbling up about how race and the wokeness of the cast members of the Real Housewives of New York City has had an impact on ratings on the show. And in the wake of a decision by Bravo thus far to postpone a reunion for the first time in 13 years. So we're going to get into a little bit of that. Pop culture and race and how it intersects with someone who's been there on the inside out, my sister Jill Zarin. Stay tuned.